Trevor Jackson reviewed the report of Anya Creed's whereabouts. It had taken several hours to pass from the two men in the van in New York through three successive layers of cutouts before it reached his ear. He pulled the photo of Anya out of the file and stared at it for the 100th time, as if it might contain some hidden clue to the woman's success. But there was nothing there he hadn't seen before. And yet, his instinct told him he was missing something, something important. But what? He considered what he'd read in the file, the many adventures the woman had been involved in, the many times she'd escaped at the last minute, slipping away from death's bony grasp.
What happened before doesn't matter. This time, Anya Creed will not escape.
Anya had some planning to do before she'd be able to get herself to Paris. No easy feat when the police and a few killers were looking for her. She tried to concentrate, but no matter how hard she tried, she couldn't get her mind to focus. It kept coming back to the events of the past few days, worrying at them like a dog with a bone. She knew she was missing something, something that tied all this together somehow, but she just couldn't figure out what it was. And until she did, it seemed her subconscious just wasn't going to leave her in peace. Which explained why, with police and criminals searching the globe for her, Anya went for a run. The air was crisp and cool enough that she could see her breath each time she exhaled. She'd run in worse conditions, however, far worse. And she knew a little bite in the air wouldn't slow her down any. It might, in fact, help her feel more calm when she got back to the warmth of her hotel room. She could feel the frustration and tension of the past few days pouring out of her. After the first mile, she felt good. After the second, great. By the time she had the third one behind her, she began to feel a little tired, and that was her signal to head back to the hotel. Maybe now, with that gentle ache running through her bones, she could sit down and make some plans. The clerk wasn't at the desk when she came in, but she didn't think much of it. As she neared the top of the fifth flight of stairs, her thoughts on the warm shower awaiting her, she heard the floor of the hallway above her creak as someone shifted their weight. She stood where she was, her gaze fixed on the landing still several steps above her. When no one appeared after a long moment, she lifted her left foot and very carefully took a lateral step toward the wall. She knew the floor would be less worn there, less apt to creak and groan. And right now, she didn't know how many were waiting up there for her, and even the smallest advantage might be important. She was three steps from the top of the stairwell, and she kept her gaze fixed firmly on the landing above her, waiting. If the sound had, in fact, simply been the innocent result of someone coming down the hallway toward the stairwell, they'd appear above her any second now. No one was coming. Yet she knew someone was there. She could sense them waiting above her. The landing at the top of the steps was a few feet wide, just enough space for a person to take a step or two before intersecting the end of the corridor that stretched away at a 90-degree angle to the left. Since she couldn't see anyone standing on the landing, the sound must have come from the corridor itself. Perhaps, like her, whoever was waiting for her was pressed up against the wall on the other side of the corner, ready to jump out at her when she came around it. She glanced back down the staircase behind her and saw that it was still empty. That was good. It meant they weren't trying to box her in. They weren't professionals, then, she thought with an inward sigh of relief. Her chances of coming through this without serious injury had just gotten better. It probably wasn't the cops either, for they would have been waiting for her in the lobby, reducing the potential threat to the hotel's other patrons and giving the cops more room to maneuver if the need presented itself. That left only the people who'd tried to kill her twice already, the Red Hand Defenders, if that's even what they were really called.
He's nervous. He doesn't know where I went or what I'm doing.
Anya summoned her sword to hand, very carefully, so as not to make any noise that might give her away. Anya lifted one foot and placed it on the step above her, and then slowly settled her weight on it. When it didn't make any noise, she shifted her weight, lifting her other foot and bringing it up next to the first. Now she was one step closer to whoever was waiting for her above. She paused, listening. And when she didn't hear a response, she repeated the procedure, then did it again, until she stood on the landing. She kept her back away from the wall, not wanting to brush against it, and moved right up to the very edge of the corner. She imagined what they must look like, both of them pressed up against opposite sides of the same corner, each of them waiting for the other to make a move, doing their best not to give anything away in the process. Anya had no intention of letting him go first. Anya spun around the corner in a low crouch. The hall was empty.
One down.
It was only when she rose out of her crouch and moved forward a few steps that she could see the door to the room she had rented was open slightly, the light from inside spilling out into the corridor like an arrow directing her path. She quietly moved to the other side of the hallway so that she would be on the same side as her room, and then approached at a slow and careful pace. She held her sword before her like a talisman, prepared to deal with anyone who emerged from her room, but she reached it before anyone did so. With the tip of her sword, she slowly pushed the door open. There was a man standing on the far side of her hotel room, his back to the door. The contents of her backpack was strewn on the bed in front of him, and he was slicing up what little clothing she had with a knife to see if she had hidden anything inside the seams. Anya's gaze flicked to the baseboard where she'd hidden the torque. It was undisturbed.
Well, anyone out there?
The intruder looked up. Their gazes met across the room. He went for the silenced pistol lying on the bed in front of him. Anya turned and flung the sword. It tumbled end over end, embedded itself point first in the intruder's chest. The sword slammed him into the wall behind him, pinning him in place like a butterfly to a specimen board. His shot at her went wild. The bullet slammed into the wall a good 2 feet to her left. The man hung there, his eyes wide with surprise, blood pooling at the edge of his mouth as his strength rushed away from him and the gun fell to the floor at his feet. From across the room, Anya willed the sword to disappear.
You son of a...
Anya crossed the room and kicked the gun away, then stuck her head in the bathroom to assure herself that it was empty. Satisfied that they were alone, Anya knelt in front of the dying man. He was already staring off into the distance, and Anya knew he didn't have long. Still, she had to try.
Who sent you? What do you want?
The sound of her voice seemed to bring him back to the here and now, but it wasn't enough. He looked in her direction, opened his mouth to say something. Anya watched it happen, not feeling anything. These people had tried to kill her several times now. She held no sympathy for them. It didn't matter if they were just following orders. That wasn't an excuse in her book. The sound in the hallway outside her room brought back her sense of urgency. The gunshot might have been silenced, but eventually someone was going to use that stairwell, and they'd find what was left of her first assailant. She couldn't be there when that happened. But first, she had to know. She reached forward and tore open the man's shirt. The tattoo of a red hand stared back at her. Anya hailed a cab outside the hotel to get into the heart of London. Right now, she wanted to lose herself amid the crowds. The route the cab driver took followed the Thames into the city, and as they came up Cannon Street, Anya saw the familiar logo of a Federal Express office. Inspiration struck at the sight.
Can you pull over and wait a few moments?
The driver was more than happy to oblige. She went inside and approached the desk, asking for help in locating the address of the Hotel Apollinaire in the Montparnasse section of Paris. She'd stayed there before. She remembered it as a nice hotel on a quiet street, and most definitely a step up from the kind of place she'd just left behind. With the address in hand, Anya retired to a table in the corner and, with the help of some materials she'd purchased from the clerk, packed up the torque for shipping. As she was getting ready to fill out the label, she called the hotel on her cell phone.
Registration, please.
She was on hold for only a minute or two before a clerk at the front desk answered.
Hotel Apollinaire, how may I help you?
I'd like to speak to Stéphane Marcineau. Is he in today?
One moment, please.
This time, the wait was considerably longer, but finally, Anya heard a familiar voice on the other end of the line.
This is Stéphane. How may I help you?
Stéphane, it's Anya. Anya Creed.
This was the tricky part. Stéphane was the manager of the Apollinaire. A few years before, two men tried to rob the place, one of them holding Stéphane and one of the desk clerks at gunpoint, while the other worked to clean out the hotel safe. Anya came in from a late night out and walked right into the situation. But rather than being cowed by the presence of the gun, as the robbers clearly expected her to be, Anya jumped to the offensive, disarming the first man and getting his captives to safety before anything could happen to them. The police caught the other man a few blocks away. A potentially terrible situation had been averted, and Stefan promised his undying support if there was anything he could do for her. Anya needed help. She was going to call in that favor. There was a moment of hesitation.
Just a moment, please, madame.
She heard the receiver being placed on the desk, and then the sound of a door closing somewhere on the other side. A second later, Stefan was back on the line with her.
Anya, I saw you on the news. Are you all right?
Just as she feared, word of the attack went international, thanks in no small part, she was sure, to Doug's impromptu press conference. Now came the real test.
I'm fine, Stefan, but I need some help.
Oh, anything. Name it.
I'm on my way to Paris and need a place to stay for a few days while I sort all this out.
Say no more. When do you expect to arrive?
Tomorrow afternoon.
I've got a room reserved for you under the name Alison Smith. Ask for Suzette when you get here, as I'll be off duty then. I'll have everything taken care of. All you have to do is see Suzette and pick up your key. Understand?
Thank you so much, Stefan.
After what you did? Oh, think nothing of it.
Anya finished filling out the paperwork for the package and addressed it to Alison Smith at the Hotel Apollinaire. She put a hold for guest note on it as well. When she was done, she dropped it into the slot designated for such parcels, and that was that. For the time being, the Torque was safe. If the RHD discovered that she'd fled England for the continent, they'd most likely look for her in the same hole-in-the-wall kind of place she'd stayed in London, so upgrading a few levels above that could throw them off the scent for a little while. Hopefully, she'd have completed her business in Paris by the time they figured out what she'd done. She knew that having some help on the ground in Paris would certainly make things easier, so she tried Rue's number again. As before, all she reached was his voicemail.
I need your help. Please, call me as soon as possible.
As she headed for the door, she spotted a do-it-yourself photo printing kiosk across the room. Making a split-second decision, she detoured over to it and used the SD card from her digital camera to print out several of the pictures she'd taken of the Torque after it had been cleaned. It seemed a prudent thing to do, given her planned meeting with Dr. Deschamps the next day. Returning to the cab, she quizzed the driver for a few moments about the various means of crossing the English Channel. Without a car of her own, she couldn't use the Channel, and she soon discovered that the only other alternatives, short of flying, were to take either a train or a ferry.
The train is faster and much more comfortable. The fare is reasonable as well.
The ferry isn't?
Reasonable, yes. Faster, comfortable, no.
Anyone following her would expect her to take the fastest route possible.
Take me to the ferry, please.
Which one? The most popular runs the Dover to Calais route. The cost of each trip depends on just where you want to end up. You might try the ferry at Portsmouth. It'll take you over to Cherbourg in just under 4 hours. From Cherbourg, you catch a train directly into Paris. That tucks on another 3 hours to your trip, but it does put you right in the city.
That'll do.
With things now in the hands of the cabbie, Anya leaned back in her seat and stared out of the window.
Miss?
Anya heard the voice as if from a long way off. She tried to ignore it at first.
Miss!
She found herself staring into the cabbie's face as she leaned across the front seat, trying to get her attention.
We're here, miss.
She glanced around, trying to remember where here actually was. The smell of the sea and the sight of the ship at the dock nearby brought it all back to her. She paid the cabbie with some of the money she'd taken from the dead operative and got out of the car, blinking in the sunlight. The ferry was already loading as she approached, the long line of cars in front of the ramp moving slowly forward at the direction of the crew members who stood at the boat's stern. Despite this being one of the slower routes across the channel, there were still plenty of cars being brought on board, as well as a decent crowd of pedestrians like her waiting to board at the gangplank. The more the merrier, Anya thought. Less chance of anyone picking her out of the crowd. With the brim of her hat pulled down low and her face pointed at the ground, Anya approached the ticket window.
Round trip, please.
She slid her cash through the slot below the window. The clerk printed her ticket and slid that plus her change back in the other direction. Anya joined the line, waiting to board the boat. This was the most dangerous part of the process for her, when no one particularly had anything to do other than stand around and stare at their fellow passengers. She was using a fake passport she always kept with her, as emergencies were frequent since she'd claimed the sword. She kept her eyes on the ground, didn't look at anyone else, and made it onto the boat without anyone shouting out her name in surprise. Once on board, she made her way up several flights of stairs until she reached the upper deck. Here, the passenger seats were out in the open air, and on a chilly day such as this, the deck was far less occupied than any of the enclosed ones below. For Anya, it was the best place on the boat to keep the chance of being recognized to a minimum. She found a seat, settled down, and waited for the ship to get underway. She noticed the man watching her about half an hour after they left Portsmouth. He was dark-haired, dressed in blue jeans and a light jacket, with a backpack slung over one shoulder. She'd seen him on the deck with her, but didn't really pay attention until she'd gone down to the galley deck to get out of the wind for a few minutes and grab something to fill her empty stomach, only to have him show up there a few minutes later as well. She caught him giving her the eye several times as she waited in line.
So he thinks you're attractive. Is that such a big deal?
Normally, it wouldn't be. Having men find her attractive was something she dealt with on a regular basis. But right now, when it felt like half the world was looking for her, being followed made her distinctly uncomfortable.
How could they have found me this fast? For that matter, how did they do it in the first place?
Rather than return to the upper deck, Anya spent some time walking around one of the mid-decks, turning things over in her head, trying to find the pattern, the connection between recent events. As she stood looking out the window, she glanced sideways and saw the man again. He was a short distance away and was studiously being certain not to look in her direction. In fact, it was his very stillness that caught her eye. It was out of place among the other passengers who were laughing and talking, trying to pass the time. Very casually, she continued turning, pretending to be looking for someone, a friend, a lover. But in truth, she was scanning the rest of the passengers, trying to determine if the dark-haired man was alone. As far as she could tell, he was.
Big mistake, my friend.
She stepped away from the window and headed for the exit, being sure to walk straight past where he was standing. He didn't turn and look at her as she went past, though his body went stiff with tension.
Amateur.
Anya stepped out into the passageway and immediately increased her pace, putting some distance between the two of them should he try to follow, so that she could be sure that she had time to spring her trap if she needed to. She passed several people going the other way and used the cover they provided to glance behind her. Her pursuer was just coming out of the compartment she'd vacated, pushing his way past several of those standing in the passageway, as if afraid Anya would get so far ahead that he'd lose her.
Game on.
She led him down passageway after passageway and through compartment after compartment, always staying just a bit ahead of him until she was certain that he was acting alone. If anyone had been working with him, they would have boxed her in long before now. Time to turn the tables. She was half a corridor length ahead of him. As he rounded the corner behind her, she pulled open a door marked Crew Only and slipped inside. If he was just an overzealous fan looking for an autograph, the sign would more than likely stop him. But if he was following her for other reasons, if he was a cop, or more likely, a member of the RHD, then he'd blow right through it like it wasn't there. The room Anya found herself in was full of various pieces of machinery. She slipped into the shadows beside one. A moment passed. She waited, listening to footsteps approach. Her dark-haired pursuer stepped into view, his attention on the door on the opposite wall. In one move, Anya grabbed the man, slammed him against some machinery, and brought the blade to his throat.
Who are you?
The man's eyes were wide with fear, his head straining upward as he tried to keep his neck as far from the edge of her blade as possible.
Mike Gilmore.
Anya started. She hadn't been expecting him to actually answer her.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
She put a little more upward pressure on the sword. Mike rose up on his toes.
Take it easy, lady. I'm not a rapist or anything, I promise.
I asked you a question. If you don't want a back-alley tracheotomy, I suggest you answer me.
Rather than send him into a panic, The notion that she might actually carry through with her threat and slit his throat seemed to steady him.
I'm a reporter for the Minneapolis Sun-Times.
He stared directly at her, as if he might foresee her intent in her eyes.
I'm here on vacation and just happened to recognize you when I boarded the ferry. I thought I might have a chance at a story.
By following me?
I wanted to see what you were doing, but didn't want to get too close. I guess I'm not too good at this kind of thing.
Got an idea to back up that story?
He began to nod, then thought better of it when he felt the sword beneath his chin.
Left pocket. You are Anya Creed, right? I mean, I didn't get myself into this mess for nothing, did I?
Keeping the sword right where it was, Anya fished into the pocket of his coat and pulled out a lanyard that had an ID clip to it. It was a standard press ID, with his name and photo over that of the newspaper. Still, it paid to be certain.
Take off your shirt.
What?
She gave the sword a little twist, watching a drop of blood well up under its tip.
Take off your shirt.
As he moved to do as he was told, Anya took the sword away from his throat, but kept it trained on his chest. One hard thrust would be all it would take. Mike apparently recognized that, or else had concluded that he was dealing with a complete madwoman, for he made no move to escape. Instead, he let his jacket fall to the floor, and then whipped his shirt over his head, exposing a decently muscled chest.
Turn around.
And a pair of bare shoulders. No tattoo. Satisfied, Anya stepped back, giving him a little more room.
Okay, you can get dressed.
His shoulders slumped, and he almost shut his eyes in relief, but then he remembered there was an angry woman with a sword in front of him, and they snapped open again. Anya found it almost comical. As she watched him pull his shirt back on, she considered the current situation. Not for the first time since she'd fled the dig site, she didn't know what to do. Clearly, he was telling the truth, but rather than helping her out, that fact created more problems for her. He knew who she was and where she was. If she let him go, he would probably take that information right to the police. Heck, he didn't even need to wait that long. He could go to the ship's captain and have him radio ahead so that when they arrived in France, there would be law enforcement officers waiting there for her. On the other hand, he was an innocent, and she couldn't just get rid of him, convenient as that might be. Garin, and possibly even Rue, wouldn't think twice about it. But Anya just couldn't bring herself to do such a thing. She was going to have to find a way to convince him not to turn her in.
What did you hope to get out of following me?
A story, of course. Ever since your producer gave that idiotic press conference, people have been wondering where you were and what exactly your involvement is in the Bog Mummy case.
Is that what they're calling it? The Bog Mummy case?
For the first time, Mike looked embarrassed.
Yeah, it kind of stuck after your producer made that wild-ass comment about bog mummies.
Anya was silent for several long minutes, trying to figure out her next move. Thankfully, Mike had a solution.
Look, despite the sword in the throat thing, I don't think you're dangerous, nor do I believe that you had anything to do with the murders of those scientists. If you did, you already would have run me through with that pig sticker of yours, right? So, how about we do this? I'll keep my mouth shut about seeing you here if you give me an exclusive on the story.
Anya let the silence grow. He who talks first loses, she thought. An old sales saying she'd picked up from somewhere. She had to admit it was a truism if she'd ever heard one.
Okay.
Okay? Really?
Really. You allow me to get off this ship without informing the authorities, and I promise to give you an exclusive interview when all is said and done.
Why not now?
Because I'm still trying to put it all together.
But you promised to give me the full story before you speak to anyone else. A total exclusive? You'll tell me everything?
Certainly not everything, she thought, looking at the sword in her hand.
Of course.
How do I know you're telling the truth?
Are you suggesting I'd lie to you?
She could see he was about to answer yes, but then he caught sight of the sword she still held.
No, not at all. I just wanted to be clear.
I understand your predicament. If you walk away and I don't make good on my promise, you'll be missing out on a huge story. On the other hand, I have to trust you as much as you have to trust me.
Yeah, but you're the one holding the sword, not me. You can make me agree to anything just by sticking me with that thing again.
True, but I haven't. Well, not enough to mention. Give me your notebook and a pen.
Frowning, he did what he was told, passing over a black notebook that he had in the back pocket of his jeans. Anya took it, turned to a clean page, and wrote out a short note to Doug, telling him to draw up a contract giving the Minneapolis Sun-Times and its reporter, Michael Gilmore, an exclusive interview with her on the Bog Mummy case when she was freely able to do so. She instructed him to sign it on behalf of both her and the studio, and to keep a copy for their own records. When she was finished, she read it over a second time, but decided against changing anything. Short and to the point, that was the best way of dealing with Doug. When she was finished, she handed the pad and pen back to Gilmore.
Send that to my producer, Doug Morrell, at the corporate offices in Manhattan. He'll draw you up a proper contract to see that you get what's coming to you.
Mike read the note, looked back at her for a moment, and then shrugged.
I can live with that.
It's the only way you will.
At the same time that Anya was cutting a deal with her wannabe paparazzo, Detective Inspector Beresford was entering the morgue at New Scotland Yard, intent on checking the results of the autopsies that had been done that morning on the bodies of the two men recovered from the roadside ditch south of the dig site. Clements had prepared a preliminary report after returning to the office earlier, and Beresford had read it on the way over. Fingerprint analysis identified the two men as Brian O'Donnell and Sean McGuire. Both of them had records. They'd been in and out of prison several times over the past 15 years. At first, it was just small stuff. Petty larceny, possession of stolen goods, assault and battery. But it wasn't long before they graduated to more serious crimes. The last time they'd been pinched, they ended up doing 5 years together in Swansea on an armed robbery charge. It was there, according to the file, that they'd been recruited into the Ulster Volunteer Force. Once released from prison, the two men had dropped off the radar, and that had been that. Until they were found cast aside like so much trash on the side of the road south of the dig site. It wasn't a coincidence. That much was obvious. But how they fit into the bigger picture and what their roles had been in the massacre, Beresford didn't know. It seemed clear that they met their end in a confrontation with the now infamous Anya Creed. Beresford watched the sideshow of a press conference her producer orchestrated the other day, and while it primarily raised more questions than it answered, it did seem to confirm his reasoning with regard to her behavior. If she witnessed the events at the dig site, as her producer indicated, then it would be natural for her to go into hiding, especially after fighting off a second attempt on her life. It still didn't explain why she hadn't come forward since then, and that bothered him. What was he missing? His musing ended, his question still unanswered, when he reached the guard posted outside the doors of the morgue. Beresford had to show his identification and sign the logbook before the guard would let him in for his appointment with the coroner, Jack Gibbons. Gibbons had held the post for the past 10 years, and Beresford had worked with him on a number of cases. He found the man to be both highly dedicated and extremely skilled when it came to his job. He was also a very affable fellow, once you got through his carefully cultivated, curmudgeon-like exterior. Beresford honestly liked the man, and as a result, it made this aspect of his job a little less upsetting than it might otherwise be.
How are you, Jack?
Gibbons was in his early 60s, just a few years short of put-him-out-to-pasture age, as he liked to call it. He was a large man, but moved with a grace and surety of motion. He had a full head of gleaming white hair, and often wore it in a ponytail to annoy those younger but less fortunate members of the staff who were already losing their hair at half his age.
I'm just fine. What can I do for you on this bleak and baleful day?
I heard you'd finished the post-mortem on O'Donnell and McGuire. Figured I'd get a jump on things by coming to see you rather than waiting for the official report.
Gibbons moved toward the refrigerated drawers before Beresford got half his sentence out. That was one of the things the detective liked about the man. He was good at anticipating a detective's needs on a major case, and didn't mind going around the official paperwork to give a guy a head start when necessary. The rear wall held 3 rows of refrigeration units, or storage drawers, with 4 to a row. The coroner moved directly to 2 drawers in the second row, pulling them open simultaneously.
What do you need to know?
Beresford looked down at the bodies before him, figured out who was who, and pointed at O'Donnell first.
Cause of death?
Severance of the 3rd and 4th vertebrae.
In other words, a broken neck, just as Beresford suspected at the crime scene.
Any idea what might have caused it?
From the force of the impact and the damage to the vertebrae that resulted, I'd say it was an automobile accident. Probably wasn't buckled in.
That's consistent with the scenario I'm putting together. Anything unusual I should know about?
You saw the tattoo.
Yeah, that's why I caught the case.
That's it for this one, then.
And him?
That's where things get interesting. Timing-wise, he was killed around the same time as O'Donnell, give or take a half an hour. In his case, though, death was the result of massive trauma associated with a sharp force injury that consisted of a severe stab wound in the upper left chest area.
Gibbons pulled the sheet down farther to show the wound in the corpse's chest.
The blade was close to 3 inches in width at its widest point, and at least 2.5 feet long.
He rolled the body up on one shoulder so Beresford could see the exit wound in the man's back.
I suspect it might have been even longer.
He let the body slap back into place on the steel gurney.
But I've got no way of confirming it at the moment.
So what are we talking about? A combat knife? A machete? Something like that?
A sword would be more likely, as the wound clearly shows that the weapon has a double edge.
So far, Gary Anderson's story was holding up. The first of the two victims died in the crash, the second when the woman rushed the other vehicle, weapon in hand.
Curiouser and curiouser. A sword, huh? Old or new?
No way to say for sure. Some older weapons will leave bits of particulate matter in the wound. Tiny slivers of metal that break free of the blade when it strikes a hard surface like a bone. Maybe flakes of rust if the weapon hasn't been cared for all that much. But I didn't find anything like that here.
That wasn't good news. It meant Beresford would have a hard time tying the weapon to the crime itself, even if he caught the Creed woman with the sword in hand. Gibbons would be able to say that a weapon of similar make and style had been used in the attack, but without additional forensic evidence, like finding the blade stained with the blood of the victims, he couldn't make a more definitive statement.
I recovered several different fibers from the exit wound, though. The first few matched the fabric from the shirt our victim had been wearing. The removal of the sword must have pulled them back into the wound. But there were also several slivers of a dark blue fabric that I couldn't match, and I sent those over to the lab for further analysis.
Want to hazard a guess?
The angle of the entry and exit wound suggests that the weapon entered the body at a slight downward angle. So I'm guessing our victim was sitting down when it happened. I'd say the fabric is from the upholstery of whatever chair he was sitting in at the time.
Wouldn't that be nice, Beresford thought. Anderson's testimony tied Creed to the vehicle and the deaths that occurred inside it, at least circumstantially. If the fabric turned out to be automobile upholstery, and he could match that to the vehicle itself, then he could put the body in the vehicle that was involved in the pursuit of Anderson's car, thereby tying the bodies discovered at the side of the road with the events described by Anderson. It wasn't enough to secure a conviction, but it was a start. Successful investigations were like walls. They were built one brick at a time.
Anything else?
Just that he was a member of the RHD, just like his partner there. But you probably already knew that.
Yeah.
Looks like you've got a problem on your hands.
Gibbons pulled the sheets over the bodies again.
Tell me about it. Losing two of their men is going to make the RHD bloody difficult to deal with.
Two? Try four.
Four?
You mean you haven't heard?
Gibbons shook his head as if he couldn't believe it.
Follow me.
He led Beresford back across the room to where two bodies lay on wheeled stretchers under crisp blue sheets. He pulled the sheets back on both of them, exposing them from the shoulders up. The detective barely noticed their faces, for he was too busy staring at the tattoos visible on each man's shoulder. Tattoos of a red hand.
Bloody hell. Where'd you get these two?
Hotel over in Peckham. Forensic Science Services just brought them in after the responding detectives released the scene.
Oh, for the love of...
Beresford couldn't believe that they'd cleared the scene without notifying him. Given that there was already an active investigation involving members of the RHD, standard protocol demanded that the bodies remain in place until the officers involved in the primary investigation, namely him and Clements, were given a chance to view the scene as it was found. Losing four of their soldiers in less than 48 hours was not going to sit well with those in command of the RHD. There were sure to be reprisals. The trouble was, there were far too many soft targets the RHD could take advantage of, and there was no way for CT Command to cover them all. It looked like things were going to get bloody very quickly, unless he could get to the bottom of it.
You happen to have the address of that hotel.
Anya glanced at her watch as a well-dressed young woman of Asian descent led her through the maze of hallways in the restricted part of the Natural History Museum. Despite her trials on the ferry and a long, uncomfortable train ride, she was right on time for her appointment with Dr. Deschamps. Finally, they reached his office.
Come in.
Dr. Deschamps was tall and thin, reminding Anya of a scarecrow that climbed down off his pole and learned to walk. He had a narrow, lined face that gave his mouth a pinched look, but his eyes were sparkling and full of life. She put his age at somewhere around 65.
Ah, you must be Miss Creed. Please come in. Sit down.
He indicated the chair in front of his desk with the wave of a hand.
Oh, thank you for taking the time to see me.
Skip the formalities, please. I'm too old to waste time on such nonsense. Let's talk one colleague to another. Tell me about this black talk you found.
Anya explained about the recent dig in the West Midlands. She kept waiting for him to interrupt and tell her he knew all of this from the newscasts, but he did not. Apparently, Dr. Deschamps was one of the few people who had not heard about the recent tragedy. She explained how the torque had been found around the neck of the Iceni chieftain they'd pulled from the bog's clutches, though she conveniently left out the part about how they'd known where to dig. When it came time to describe the torque, she simply handed over the copies of the photographs she had made the day before. Deschamps studied them for several minutes. Anya could feel the tension in the room rise as he did so, though she didn't understand why. When he was finished looking at the pictures, Deschamps leaned forward in his seat, his gaze intense.
Do you have the talk with you, by chance?
No, I'm sorry. I wasn't able to obtain permission in time to remove it from the site.
There was something about the way Deschamps asked the question that made Anya a little uneasy, and she didn't think twice about lying to him.
Well, that's too bad.
He put the photos on his desk for the moment.
It would have been interesting to see it.
A frown crossed his face for a second. There and gone so quickly, Anya wasn't even certain she'd seen it.
So, how can I help you?
Well, you didn't sound surprised to hear that there was a torque like this out there, so I'm assuming you've heard of it?
Yes. There are one or two stories that mention a black torque, but they generally refer to it by its given name, the Tear of the Gods.
The Tear of the Gods? I didn't come across that name in my research.
Deschamps leaned back and got comfortable.
You've heard of Boudica and her rebellion against Rome?
Yes. Like most of those who've tried to throw off the yoke of the Empire, it failed.
Quite right. But there are some who say that the failure was not due to her lack of intelligence or tactical know-how, but rather a result of the fact that she gave up her most prized possession.
Let me guess. The Tear of the Gods?
The very same. According to the legend, a lowly blacksmith, his name now lost to history, was present when the Roman governor ordered his troops to rape Boudica and her daughters in punishment for the fact that her deceased husband, the previous ruler of the area, insulted the emperor by leaving the region to Boudica in his will. Enraged at the Roman treatment of his queen, the blacksmith called upon the gods to help him fashion a weapon of mighty power, one that would overthrow the empire and keep this from ever happening again. Andraste, goddess of victory, heard his plea. But being a woman, and a beautiful one at that, she appeared to the blacksmith in a dream and convinced him to make a necklace instead of a sword. When the blacksmith agreed, Andraste wept bitter tears over the queen's plight. As her tears fell to earth, they were collected by the blacksmith and mixed with the other ingredients he had chosen at the goddess's suggestion. From that mixture, the talk was formed.
Deschamps checked to be certain Anya was following the story, which she was.
Some versions claim that the goddess was Agrona, goddess of war instead of Andraste. But that's not really all that important.
He waved a hand to show his dismissal of the issue.
The key here is that the Celts believed that the material used to make the torque came from the gods themselves, and was therefore imbued with mystical powers. Both Agrona and Andraste are gods associated with war, so a legend sprang up that anyone wearing the black torque would prove invincible in combat, that they couldn't be defeated by man or gods.
Why haven't I heard of this legend before?
Aside from the fact that Celtic mythology isn't the most likely cocktail party conversation, the legend is a very minor one, and it died out fairly quickly, given what happened to Boudica.
Anya could understand that. It was hard to claim that the necklace made the bearer unbeatable in battle when the Romans crushed Boudica's rebellion so handily. Anya thought about Big Red.
Could Boudica have given the torque to someone else before the big battle?
It's certainly possible, but I tend to doubt it.
Why's that?
If she had given it to another, say her most trusted lieutenant or someone like that, the legend would have lived on. We would have heard additional stories of the torque's existence. Instead, it disappears from history shortly after Boudica's death. Unless the person to whom it was given was himself killed shortly thereafter, and no one knew he carried it. In fact, until your call the other day, I would have said that the Black Torque was nothing more than a myth. It would appear that you'll have the chance to prove me wrong.
He picked up one of the photos, giving it a closer look.
This certainly isn't gold. Could it be iron?
I don't think so. Or if it is, it's iron mixed with something else I don't recognize.
It's not all that often that you stumble upon the tears of a goddess, now, is it?
Hardly. One of my next steps is to have it analyzed.
Deschamps put the photo back with the others and then handed the whole stack back to Anya.
I think that's an excellent idea. Do you have anyone in mind for the work?
Not yet, I'm afraid.
Would you object to a suggestion?
Not at all.
The best geologist in town is Sebastian Cartier. If I was in charge of the torque, he's the one I'd take it to. The trouble is that with all the work he does for the oil and mineral companies, he's usually booked for months in advance. Thankfully, he owes me a favor. A big one. Would you like me to give him a call?
Anya smiled back at him.
I'd appreciate that very much.
Deschamps picked up the phone and dialed a number from memory.
Sebastian? It's Harry. I need some help.
A few minutes later, it was all arranged. Anya was to stop by Cartier's office at 9 the next morning, supposedly after having the torque sent via overnight courier to her address, after which the geologist would do a series of tests aimed at identifying exactly what the torque was made of and how old it might actually be. In return, Anya promised to have a copy of the results sent over to Deschamps' office and to arrange for him to view the piece at a later date. Given the hoops she would have been forced to jump through to accomplish that on her own, Anya felt very lucky indeed to have made the trip to Paris to meet Deschamps. After a few more minutes of polite discussion, Anya thanked the professor one more time and then took her leave, anxious to get to her hotel and be certain the torque had arrived without incident.
And thank you so much for your help.
It was nothing.
No sooner had the American woman left his office than Deschamps picked up his phone again and dialed another number. To Deschamps' surprise, it was answered after only a few rings by Shaw himself.
She just left.
The two men had met years earlier at a conference and recognized in each other a certain mutual interest in seeing the occasional archaeological artifact get rerouted into the hands of a private individual from time to time. The association had made Deschamps a very rich man, and the opportunity before him at this moment made all the other transactions they'd conducted pale in comparison. He had no intention of missing it.
Does she have the torque?
No, not yet. But she is having it sent to her via overnight courier, so that she can have it dated and chemically analyzed tomorrow. She'll be at Sebastian Cartier's at 9 tomorrow morning.
Beresford stood in the lobby of the surprisingly tawdry hotel recently occupied by the American TV star Anya Creed.
Shows you just never know.
A nervous-looking young woman in her mid-20s with a bad case of acne watched him from the front desk, one hand held out of sight beneath the counter. To keep the clerk from getting nervous and blasting away with whatever she had hidden under there, the detective held up his ID as he approached the desk.
Police.
The clerk relaxed. Anticipating Beresford's next request, she took out a key card and passed it across the counter to the detective.
Fifth floor, room 511. You'll have to walk, though. The elevator's out.
Of course it is.
Beresford had a look around. It was your typical flea-bag hotel room. A narrow bed, a beat-up dresser, and a nightstand with a television bolted to it. The bloodstain near the bed had dried hours before, but the thick scent of it still filled the room. A fine black powder coated many of the room's surfaces, evidence that the forensics team had already dusted for prints. Good luck with that, he thought. It looked like the room had been cleaned once a month. The place would have dozens, if not hundreds, of fingerprints all over it. Beresford crossed the room, glanced into the adjoining bathroom, then squatted down near the bloodstain. From the way it spread across the floor, Beresford surmised that the man had been in a seated position when he died, his back to the wall. They still didn't have an ID on either of the victims, but Gibbons told him the pattern had been repeated. One died from a broken neck, and the other bled to death from a stab in the chest with a long-bladed weapon.
It seems anyone who gets in Miss Creed's way ends up dead. I'd best be extra careful when I take her into custody.
After staring at the bloodstain for a few minutes without learning anything more, Beresford got up and turned to leave. That's when he saw it. A section of the baseboard near the dresser had been pulled free of the wall. By getting down on his hands and knees, he could see that there was a small recessed space at the bottom of the wall that normally would have been covered by the baseboard. He took out his keychain to use his penlight to peer inside the hole. The light revealed a cavity about 3 inches deep and 6 inches long. It was the perfect place to hide something small, and in fact, he could see that the dust inside the space had recently been disturbed. The space itself was empty. The detective got up and dusted himself off, his thoughts churning. He'd originally thought that the Creed woman might have been in on the attack at the dig site. The more he learned about her, however, the more unlikely that theory seemed to be. While everyone had their price, a fact that had been proved in his line of work again and again, what he'd been able to dig up on her showed that she was a staunch defender of those who couldn't fight for themselves. She was also well-liked and respected in the archaeological community. She seemed to have friends everywhere. So the idea that she would turn on the very people who supported and welcomed her into their midst was just too far-fetched for even a cynic like him. Given that assessment, he'd been forced to revise his theory over the past 24 hours to one that put her on the run from those who'd slain her companions rather than a willing accomplice. Now it looked like she was intentionally hiding something from them as well. The space behind the baseboard wasn't all that big. That meant the sword she'd apparently been using on those who came after her wasn't the item in question. She might have taken it from the dig site, as he suspected, but it wasn't what the RHD thugs were after. No, it was more likely that it was something far more damaging to those involved, such as photographs or possibly even video footage of the attack on the dig site. Otherwise, why else would they be pursuing her? Satisfied that he'd gotten everything possible from the scene, Beresford locked the room behind him and returned to the lobby.
Are you Jenny Hanscom?
He handed the desk clerk the key.
I didn't have anything to do with it.
To do with what?
Whatever you're here to ask me about, I didn't have nothing to do with it.
I don't care what you did or didn't do. I just want to talk to you about what happened last night.
I already told the other cops everything.
What she'd told the first responders had been bull, plain and simple. Two men had died, one of them rather violently, and she hadn't seen or heard a thing? He decided to try a different method. Pulling a 20-pound note out of his pocket, he laid it down on the counter, but didn't take his hand all the way off it. The clerk glanced at it and then licked her lips.
I've got a few questions that the other guys probably forgot to ask. Help me out and I'll make it worth your while.
The girl looked at the money again and then nodded.
The report said you were working the front desk when this happened. That right?
Another sullen nod. Beresford wasn't going to put up with talking to a bobblehead doll. He slid the money back off the counter.
Hey, It's no skin off my back whether or not you want to earn some extra cash. Either you talk here, where things are nice and comfortable, or I can haul your scrawny slacker self to New Scotland Yard. Which is it?
Hanscom glared at him for a minute, but couldn't keep it up.
Yeah, I was on duty.
Beresford smiled, a friendly kind of grin, as a little positive reinforcement.
And you always stay right here at the desk during your shift.
Where else would I be?
Where else would you be, indeed? So then you saw the two guys come in, right?
Hanscom suddenly looked uncomfortable.
I don't remember.
You don't remember? But I thought you said you were right here for your whole shift. How could you have missed them?
I don't know. Maybe I was helping another guest.
More likely you were goofing around out back, Beresford thought.
Tell me about the woman who rented the room.
Good-looking bird.
What else do you remember? Was she tall, short, blonde, brunette, or redhead?
Beresford walked her through a physical description, checking it against the one she'd already given to the responding officers. It held up pretty well. More importantly, it matched the one Father Anderson gave of Amy, the woman he'd picked up on the side of the road. Beresford pulled out a publicity photo of Anya Creed he'd printed off the web and put it down on the counter.
This her?
Hanscom's eyes widened as she looked again and saw the caption identifying her as the star of Chasing History's Monsters.
Yeah, that's her. I checked her in.
Did she come in alone?
As far as I know.
What do you mean?
A lot of guests check in alone. Doesn't mean they stay that way. Sometimes people don't want other people to know their business, if you catch my drift. So they have the other person wait outside till the coast is clear. Or they let them in through the back.
Miss Creed didn't seem like the type to be setting up illicit trysts in a fleabag hotel, so Beresford let the comment pass.
Do you remember what time she checked in?
Hanscom shrugged again, a habit that was starting to annoy Beresford.
Late at night? 2, maybe 3 a.m.?
Beresford nodded, doing a quick mental calculation to be certain that she would have had enough time to get there if she had, in fact, been involved in the events that occurred on the road near the dig site. Turns out she could have made it here with time to spare, actually.
Did she have anything with her when she came in? A wrapped package? A long box? Anything like that?
No. Just a backpack.
You're sure?
While he couldn't see her just walking into the hotel sword in hand, it didn't feel right that she'd just leave it outside either. However, he wasn't about to solve that puzzle.
Hell yeah, I'm sure.
He'd been operating on the idea that the RHD soldiers had followed Creed from the dig site, but it occurred to him that perhaps she'd just stumbled on them by accident. Just to be certain that the hotel wasn't being used as a base of operations by the terrorist group, he pulled out photos of O'Donnell and McGuire and showed them to Hanscom. If the four men had met there previously, perhaps she'd seen them before. No such luck, however.
Anything else you can remember?
The clerk thought for about a minute, and then nodded, much to Beresford's surprise.
She had something all over the front of her shirt. Big, reddish stain. First I thought it was blood, but then I figured it had to be paint or something, since she'd have to kill someone to have that much.
She visibly paled as she realized the possible connection between the two events. The expression on Hanscom's face actually brought a chuckle out of Beresford. It surprised him, given the day he'd had.
Did she appear hurt or injured in any way?
Hanscom shook her head. Okay, then, so it wasn't her blood. Best guess was that it was McGuire's, and she'd probably gotten it on herself when she dragged his body out of the car. If he could find the clothes, he'd have a direct link between her and McGuire. That would be a big step in the right direction.
All right. Thanks.
Beresford slapped the 20-pound note on the counter in front of him and headed back to his car. Figuring Creed would have ditched her blood-stained clothing the first chance she got, he called Clements.
Hello.
Get half a dozen uniforms out into this neighborhood. I need them to find a very bloody woman's shirt as soon as possible. Miss Creed's struck again, but I still don't know where to find her.